been more accurate. Although their captives often ended up in the Arab world, the traders on the African mainland were largely Swahili-speaking Africans from territory that today is Kenya and Tanzania. Many had adopted Arab dress and Islam, but only some of them were of even partly Arab descent. Nonetheless, from Edinburgh to Rome, indignant books and speeches and sermons denounced the vicious Arab slavers. And with them, by implication, the idea that any part of Africa might be colonized by someone other than Europeans. All these European impulses toward Africa, anti-slavery zeal, the search for raw materials, Christian evangelism, and sheer curiosity, were embodied in one man, David Livingstone, physician, prospector, missionary, explorer, and at one point even a British consul. He wandered across Africa for 3 decades, starting in the early 1840s. He searched for the source of the Nile, denounced slavery, found Victoria Falls, looked for minerals, and preached the gospel. As the first white man to cross the continent from coast to coast, he became a national hero in England. In 1866, Livingstone set off on another long expedition, looking for slave traders, potential Christians, the Nile, or anything else that might need discovering. Years passed, and he did not return. As people began to wonder about his fate, New York Herald publisher James Gordon Bennett saw a great opportunity. In 1869, or so went the story Stanley would tell, Stanley received an urgent telegram from Bennett, his boss, "Come to Paris on important business." A journalist, Stanley wrote with the self-importance that had now become part of his public persona, is like a gladiator in the arena. Any flinching, any cowardice, and he is lost. The gladiator meets the sword that is sharpened for his bosom. The roving correspondent meets the command that may send him to his doom. He dashed to Paris to meet his publisher at the Grand Hotel. There, a dramatic conversation about Livingstone climaxed with Bennett saying, "I mean that you shall go and find him wherever you may hear that he is, and to get what news you can of him, and perhaps the old man may be in want. Take enough with you to help him should he require it. Do what you think best, but find Livingstone." This scene provided a splendid introduction for Stanley's first book, How I Found Livingstone, and it made Bennett, to whom the volume is dedicated, appear the far-sighted initiator of the great adventure. But nothing like this conversation seems to have happened. The pages of Stanley's journal for the dates around the alleged meeting with Bennett have been torn out, and in fact, Stanley did not even begin looking for Livingstone until well over a year later. However inflated, Stanley's story of Bennett's dramatic summons to Paris sold plenty of books, and to Stanley that mattered. He was after more than fame as an explorer. His melodramatic flair made him, as one historian has remarked, the progenitor of all the subsequent professional travel writers. His articles, books, and speaking tours brought him greater riches than any other travel writer of his time, and probably of the next century as well. With every step he took in Africa, Stanley planned how to tell the story once he got home. In a 20th-century way, he was always sculpting the details of his own celebrity. To leave no clues for possible competitors in the search for Livingstone, Stanley carefully spread the word, as he headed for Africa, that he was planning to explore the Rufiji River. He went first to Zanzibar to recruit porters to carry his supplies, and from there wrote a stream of letters to Katie Gough Roberts, a young woman in his hometown of Denby. Theirs had been a brief, stiff, nervous courtship, punctuated by Stanley's many departures for journalistic assignments. But in his letters he poured out his heart to her, confessing the painful secret of his illegitimate birth. Stanley planned to marry her on his return from finding Livingstone. At last, in the spring of 1871, accompanied by a dog named Omar and porters, armed guards, an interpreter, cooks, a guide carrying the American flag, and 2 British sailors, some 190 men in all, the largest African exploring expedition to date, Stanley marched inland from the east coast in search of Livingstone, who by now had not been seen by any European for 5 years. "Wherever he is," Stanley declared to his New York newspaper readers, "be sure I shall not give up the chase. If alive, you shall hear what he has to say. If dead, I will find and bring his bones to you." Stanley had to trek for more than 8 months before he found the explorer and was able to utter his famous, "Dr. Livingstone, I presume." The long search was shaped into legend by his stream of dispatches and Bennett's realization that his newspaper had one of the great human interest scoops of the century. Because Stanley was the only source of information about the search, his two white companions died during the expedition, and no one ever bothered to interview the surviving porters, the legend remained heroic. There were the months of arduous marching, the terrible swamps, the evil Arab slave traders, the mysterious deadly diseases, the perilous attacks by crocodiles, and finally Stanley's triumphant discovery of the gentle Dr. Livingstone. Livingstone was haloed in Stanley's prose, for he was the noble father figure the younger man had long been looking for, and, to some extent, had actually found. According to Stanley, the experienced sage and the bold young hero became fast friends as they explored together for several months. They sailed around the northern end of Lake Tanganyika, hoping to find the Nile flowing out, but to their disappointment found only another river flowing in. The older man passed on his wisdom to the younger before they sadly bade each other farewell and parted forever. Conveniently for Stanley, Livingstone remained in Africa and died soon afterward, before he could come home to share the spotlight or to tell the story at all differently. Stanley cannily sprinkled his tale with picturesque chiefs, exotic sultans, and faithful servants, and he introduced it with the sweeping generalizations that allowed his readers to feel at home in an unfamiliar world. The Arab never changes. The Banyan is a born trader. For the half-castes I have great contempt. Unlike the uncombative and paternalistic Livingstone, who travelled without a huge retinue of heavily armed followers, Stanley was a harsh and brutal taskmaster. "The blacks give an immense amount of trouble. They are too ungrateful to suit my fancy," he wrote while on the journey. Although they are softened by successive revisions, his writings show him given to explosive rage. He drove his men up hills and through swamps without let-up. When mud and wet sapped the physical energy of the lazily inclined, a dog-whip became their backs, restoring them to a sound, sometimes to an extravagant activity. Only half a dozen years earlier, Stanley had deserted from the U.S. Navy, but now he noted with satisfaction how the incorrigible deserters were well flogged and chained. People in the villages that the expedition marched through may well have mistaken it for another slave caravan. Like many whites who would follow him, Stanley saw Africa as essentially empty, unpeopled country, he called it. What a settlement one could have in this valley. See, it is broad enough to support a large population. Fancy a church spire rising where that tamarind rears its dark crown of foliage, and think how well a score or two of pretty cottages would look instead of those thorn clumps and gum trees. And again, there are plenty of pilgrim fathers among the Anglo-Saxon race yet, and when America is filled up with their descendants, who shall say that Africa shall not be their next resting place? To him and to his public, Stanley's future was now firmly linked to Africa. On his return to Europe, the French press compared his finding Livingstone to Hannibal's and Napoleon's crossing the Alps. Even more aptly, given Stanley's boasts about shooting anyone who got in his way, General William Tecumseh Sherman met the explorer for breakfast in Paris and likened Stanley's trip to his own scorched-earth march to the sea. The British were more hostile. The Royal Geographical Society had belatedly sent an expedition to find Livingstone, and its members had been appalled to cross paths with Stanley in Africa just as he was triumphantly boarding a ship to return home. Between the lines of huffy statements from the Society's officials was their exasperation that their native son had been found by someone who was neither a proper explorer nor a proper Englishman, but a penny-a-liner writing for the American Yellow Press. Furthermore, some in England noticed, Stanley's American accent tended to change to a Welsh one whenever he got excited. The rumours about his Welsh birth and illegitimacy worried Stanley deeply, because, writing for a jingoistic and anti-British New York newspaper, he was vigorously claiming to be American-born and bred. He sometimes implied that he came from New York, sometimes from St. Louis. Mark Twain sent congratulations to his fellow Missourian for finding Livingstone. Stanley, quick to feel rejected, especially by upper-crust Englishmen, now found himself rejected also by his fiancée. During his travels, he discovered, Katie Gough Roberts had married an architect named Bradshaw. Stanley was desperate to retrieve the letters he had sent her, particularly the one in which he had told her about his origins. But when he wrote to ask for them, she refused to give them back except in person. At a lecture he gave in Manchester, she and her husband were in the audience. Afterward, she came to the house where he was staying and asked the butler to tell him she had the letter with her. Stanley sent the butler back to the door to collect it. Once again, she refused to hand it over to anyone but Stanley. He would not go to the door, and she departed, letter in hand. His hurt pride remained like an open wound. Before long, he would once again seek solace in Africa. Chapter 2. The Fox Crosses the Stream. When word that Stanley had found Livingstone flashed over the telegraph wires in the spring of 1872, one person who followed such news with avid interest was a tall, august 37-year-old man with a spade-shaped beard, living in the rambling chateau of Laeken, on a low hill on the outskirts of Brussels. 7 years earlier, on the death of his father, Leopold II had inherited the distinctive title by which his country's monarchs were known, King of the Belgians. Belgium itself was barely older than its young monarch. After spells of Spanish, Austrian, French, and Dutch rule, it had only become independent in 1830, following a revolt against Holland. Any respectable country, of course, needed a king, and the infant nation had gone looking for one, finally settling on a German prince related to the British royal family who had taken the Belgian throne as Leopold I. The small nation was an uneasy amalgam of speakers of French and speakers of Flemish, as the Dutch spoken in Belgium's northern half was then called. In his father's court, the future Leopold II spoke French and German from childhood and soon became fluent in English. However, although he tossed a few phrases of it into speeches now and then, he never bothered to learn Flemish, spoken by more than half his subjects. In this snobbery, Leopold was not alone, for at this time his country's bitter language division marked class as well as region. Even in the north, business people and professionals tended to speak French and to look down on the impoverished Flemish-speaking farm workers and factory labourers. The marriage of Leopold's parents had been a loveless one of political convenience. Their older son was a gangling child who seemed ill at ease in the world, and his parents clearly preferred his younger brother and sister. When he was 14, Leopold's mother wrote to him, "I was very disturbed to see in the colonel's report that you had again been so lazy and that your exercises had been so bad and careless. This was not what you promised me, and I hope you will make some effort to do your homework better. Your father was as disturbed as I by this last report." The young heir took little interest in his studies, with the notable exception of geography. From the age of 10 on, he was given military training. By 15 he held the rank of lieutenant in the Belgian army, at 16 captain, at 18 major, at 19 colonel, and by the time he was 20 he was a major general. A formal portrait, painted in his late teens, shows him with sword, crimson sash and medals. The awkward young Leopold's body is pencil-thin, his gold epaulettes seem too big for his shoulders, his head too big for his torso. If Leopold wanted to see his father, he had to apply for an audience. When the father had something to tell the son, he communicated it through one of his secretaries. It was in this cold atmosphere, as a teenager in his father's court, that Leopold first learned to assemble a network of people who hoped to win his favour. Court officials proved eager to befriend the future monarch, to show him documents, to teach him how the government worked, to satisfy his passion for maps and for information about far corners of the world. Even though there was little affection between father and son, the old king was a shrewd observer. "Leopold is subtle and sly," he told one of his ministers. "He never takes a chance. The other day I watched a fox which wanted to cross a stream unobserved. First of all he dipped a paw carefully to see how deep it was, and then, with a thousand precautions, very slowly made his way across. That is Leopold's way." Leopold would not always be cautious. At times he would overreach himself or reveal too much about what prey he was after. But there was something fox-like about the manner in which this constitutional monarch of a small, increasingly democratic country became the totalitarian ruler of a vast empire on another continent. Stealth and dissembling would be his trusted devices, just as the fox relies on these qualities to survive in a world of hunters and larger beasts. In 1853, when Leopold turned 18, his father took him to Vienna and, eager for ties with the Austro-Hungarian Empire, betrothed him to an eligible young Habsburg, Archduchess Marie Henriette. No match could have been more disastrous. The 16-year-old bride was best known for her passion for horses and for a most unroyal, raucous laugh. Leopold had a distinct tendency to fall off horses and no visible sense of humour. He was an ungainly, haughty young man whom his first cousin, Queen Victoria of England, thought very odd, and in the habit of saying disagreeable things to people. Then known as the Duke of Brabant, Leopold had a pedantic obsession with trade matters, which baffled everyone. In Vienna, one lady observed that this puzzling engagement was between a stable boy and a nun, and by nun I mean the Duke of Brabant. Leopold and Marie-Henriette loathed each other at first sight, feelings that apparently never changed. Everything possible went wrong with the wedding. Leopold got scarlet fever. The train bringing the royal entourage to a carefully timed, elaborate welcoming ceremony for Marie-Henriette at the Belgian border was half an hour late, because a teenage railway telegraph operator had left his post to listen to a band concert celebrating the day. Marie-Henriette's barnyard laugh startled town hall receptions all over Belgium. On their honeymoon in Venice, she wept in public when Leopold would not let her ride in a gondola for which boatmen and musicians had already been hired. Leopold went for days at a time without speaking to her. "If God hears my prayers," she wrote to a friend a month after the wedding, "I shall not go on living much longer." Like many young couples of the day, the newlyweds apparently found sex a frightening mystery. Like few others, however, they were enlightened about it by the woman who gave her name to the age. When they paid a visit to Cousin Victoria in England, the Queen delicately expressed some doubt, in a letter to Leopold's father, as to whether the marriage had been consummated. Taking Marie-Henriette aside, she explained what was expected of her, as did her husband, Prince Albert, with the 18-year-old future king. This may have been the first time anyone had bothered to do so, for when Marie-Henriette became pregnant several years later, Leopold wrote to Albert that, "The wise and practical advice you gave me has now borne fruit." But the marriage remained miserable. Marie-Henriette fled the royal chateau of Laeken to go horseback riding for most of each day. Leopold was to find respite from his frustrations on a wider stage. When he thought about the throne that would be his, he was openly exasperated. "Petit pays, petit gens." "Small country, small people," he once said of Belgium. The country, less than half the size of West Virginia, lay between Napoleon III's much grander France and the fast-rising empire of Germany. The young heir acted peeved and impatient. The country he was to inherit seemed too small to hold him. His eyes turned abroad. Even before he was 20, Leopold, pen and notebook in hand, visited the Balkans, Constantinople, the Aegean, and Egypt, travelling in style on British and Turkish warships, and, returning home, gave tedious speeches on Belgium's potential role in world trade. Everywhere he went, he looked for imperial opportunities. He got the Khedive of Egypt to promise to form a joint steamship company connecting Alexandria with Antwerp. He tried to buy lakes in the Nile Delta so that he could drain them and claim the land as a colony. He wrote, "One could purchase a small kingdom in Abyssinia for 30,000 francs. If instead of talking so much about neutrality, Parliament looked after our commerce, Belgium would become one of the richest countries in the world." In the 19th century, as is true today, Seville was a magnificent array of fountains and walled gardens, of red-tile roofs and white stucco walls, and windows covered by wrought-iron grillwork, of orange and lemon and palm trees. Threading through the Spanish city were narrow cobblestone streets filled with visitors come to look at one of the largest Gothic cathedrals in Europe. When the 27-year-old Leopold arrived in Seville in March 1862, his purpose was not to see the cathedral or the famous mosaics and courtyards of the brightly tiled Alcazar Palace. Instead, he spent a full month in the Casa Lonja, or Old Exchange Building, a massive square structure opposite the cathedral. For two centuries, Seville was the port through which colonial gold, silver, and other riches had flowed back to Spain. Some 80 years before Leopold's visit, King Carlos III had ordered that there be gathered in this building, from throughout the country, all decrees, government and court records, correspondence, maps, and architectural drawings having to do with the Spanish conquest of the Americas. Collected under one roof, these 86 million handwritten pages, among them the supply manifest for one of Columbus's ships, have made the General Archive of the Indies one of the great repositories of the world. Indifferent to his schoolwork as a boy, with no interest whatever in art, music, or literature, Leopold was nonetheless a dedicated scholar when it came to one subject, profits. During the month he spent in Seville, he wrote home to a friend, "I am very busy here going through the Indies archives and calculating the profit which Spain made then and makes now out of her colonies." The man whose future empire would be intertwined with the 20th-century multinational corporation began by studying the records of the conquistadors. The research whetted his appetite and made him restless. He claimed that his doctors had prescribed long cruises in hot climates, and, escaping his miserable home life, he headed farther afield. In 1864, now 29 and more obsessed with colonies than ever, he set off to see the British possessions of Ceylon, India, and Burma. He also visited the East Indian islands owned, to his irritation, by Belgium's next-door neighbour, Holland, whose small size had not prevented it from acquiring lucrative colonies. The future king's interest in the Dutch East Indies was stimulated by a curious two-volume treatise called Java, or How to Manage a Colony. Fascinated by the book, Leopold began corresponding with the author, an English lawyer aptly named J.W.B. Money. Money had been impressed by the coffee, sugar, indigo, and tobacco plantations of Java, whose profits had paid for railroads and canals back in Holland. Judging from Leopold's later actions, we can guess which features of the book might have caught his eye. Money described, for example, a monopoly trading concession given to a private company, one of whose major shareholders was the Dutch king. To stimulate production, Dutch plantation owners paid bonuses to supervisors on Java in relation to the size of the crop harvested. And finally, Money noted that the huge Dutch profits from Java depended on forced labour. Leopold agreed, remarking that forced labour was the only way to civilise and uplift these indolent and corrupt peoples of the Far East. Few Belgians shared Leopold's dreams of colonies. They were deterred by practical considerations, such as their country's lack of a merchant fleet or navy, that seemed petty to him. When he returned from one of his trips, he presented to the finance minister, a vocal opponent of colonialism, a gift, a piece of marble from the ruins of the Acropolis, with a locket holding Leopold's portrait, around which was the legend, Il faut à la Belgique une colonie. Belgium must have a colony. Where was it to be found? Throughout his 20s he scoured the world. He wrote to an aide, I am specially interested in the Argentine province of Entre Rios and the very small island of Martin Garcia at the confluence of the Uruguay and the Paraná. Who owns this island? Could one buy it and establish there a free port under the moral protection of the King of the Belgians? Nothing would be easier than to become the owner of lands in the Argentine states, three or four times as big as Belgium. He invested in the Suez Canal Company. He asked an aide to try to acquire Fiji, because one should not let such a fine prey escape. He looked into railways in Brazil and into leasing territory on the island of Formosa. Leopold's letters and memos, forever badgering someone about acquiring a colony, seemed to be in the voice of a person starved for love as a child, and now filled with an obsessive desire for an emotional substitute. The way someone becomes embroiled in an endless dispute with a brother or sister over an inheritance, or with a neighbour over a property boundary. The urge for more can become insatiable, and its apparent fulfilment seems only to exacerbate that early sense of deprivation and to stimulate the need to acquire still more. During the 19th century European drive for possessions in Africa and Asia, people justified colonialism in various ways, claiming that it Christianized the heathen or civilized the savage races or brought everyone the miraculous benefits of free trade. Now, with Africa, a new rationalization had emerged, smashing the Arab slave trade. At this early stage of his career, however, the future Leopold II did not try to cloak his ambitions with such rhetoric. For him, colonies existed for one purpose, to make him and his country rich. Belgium doesn't exploit the world, he complained to one of his advisers. It's a taste we have got to make her learn. Leopold did not care whether the colonial wealth he wanted came from the precious metals sought by the Spaniards in South America, from agriculture, or, as would turn out to be the case, from a raw material whose potential was as yet undreamed of. What mattered was the size of the profit. His drive for colonies, however, was shaped by a desire not only for money, but for power. In Western Europe, after all, times were fast changing, and a king's role was not as enjoyable as it once had been. Most annoying to him was that in Belgium, as in surrounding countries, royal authority was gradually giving way to that of an elected parliament. Most annoying to him was that in Belgium, as in surrounding countries, royal authority was gradually giving way to that of an elected parliament. Someone once tried to compliment Leopold by saying that he would make an excellent president of a republic. Scornfully he turned to his faithful court physician, Jules Thiriard, and asked, "What would you say, doctor, if someone greeted you as a great veterinarian?" The ruler of a colony would have no parliament to worry about. After ascending the throne in 1865, Leopold was even more restless than before. A French marshal who saw him at a reception in Paris in 1867 thought him conspicuous by his great height, his great nose, and his great beard. With his sword, which banged his legs, he looked like a functionary who had put on his uniform without knowing how to wear it. Everyone was struck by the nose. "It is such a nose," Disraeli wrote, "as a young prince has in a fairy tale, who has been banned by a malignant fairy." At home, life went from bad to worse. In 1869, the king's 9-year-old son fell into a pond, caught pneumonia, and died. At the funeral, for the only time in his life, Leopold broke down in public, collapsing to his knees beside the coffin and sobbing uncontrollably. He had the presence of mind, however, to ask Parliament to pass a law requiring the state to pay the expenses of the royal funeral. What made the loss of his only son especially devastating was the king's firm belief that thrones and royal property were for men only. In the course of their marriage, however, Queen Marie-Henriette gave birth to 3 daughters, Louise, Stephanie, and Clémentine, but to no more sons. When the last daughter, Clémentine, was born, according to her sister Louise, the king was furious and thenceforth refused to have anything more to do with his admirable wife. "From the beginning," she wrote, "the king paid little attention to me or my sisters." Leopold unsuccessfully tried to have himself made an exception to a Belgian law requiring assets to be bequeathed to one's children. Marie-Henriette found solace with her beloved horses, which she trained herself. Princess Louise once watched as, obeying the queen's commands, a horse entered the chateau of Laeken, climbed the staircase to the queen's rooms, and descended again. Marie-Henriette befriended the Minister of War, and at manoeuvres, to the astonishment of military attachés, he sometimes invited her to lead cavalry charges. Still lacking a colony to rule, Leopold focused on building projects at home. He had a taste for monuments, great parks, broad boulevards, and grand palaces. Soon after taking the throne, he began what turned out to be a lifelong program of renovations at Laeken. Through purchases and expropriations, he enlarged the grounds of the royal estate severalfold. When one local resident refused to move, Leopold ordered an earth embankment built around the reluctant landowner's estate. Among the new buildings at Laeken was a vast string of greenhouses. When they were finally finished, a person could walk for more than a kilometer through them, the chateau, and connecting passageways without going outdoors. In later years, when the king was showing his nephew, Prince Albert, some work in progress, Albert said, "Uncle, this is going to become a little Versailles." Leopold replied, "Little?" If Leopold were a figure in fiction, his creator might, at this point in the story, introduce a foil, a minor character whose fate would sound an ominous warning about where dreams of empire can lead. But Leopold already had such a character in his life, more appropriate to the role than one a novelist could have invented. It was his sister. The Belgian royal family, always eager to form alliances with the Habsburgs, had married off Leopold's younger sister Charlotte to Archduke Maximilian, brother of the Emperor of Austria-Hungary. In 1864, Maximilian and his wife, her name appropriately changed to Carlotta, were installed by Napoleon III of France as the figurehead Emperor and Empress of Mexico, where Napoleon was maneuvering to establish a French-aligned regime. Leopold enthusiastically supported his sister's venture into empire building. As Maximilian and Carlotta set off for their new dominion, the European public cheered the handsome young couple, who were portrayed as following in the footsteps of the conquistadors. Most Mexicans, understandably, wanted no such rulers imposed on them, and they rose in rebellion. The nascent empire collapsed, and in June 1867, rebels captured and executed Maximilian. His death was inglorious, but not inelegant. He shook hands with the members of the firing squad, handed them all gold pieces, pointed to his heart, and said, "Muchachos, aim well." The previous year, Carlotta had returned to Europe to plead for support for her husband's failing regime. Napoleon III was unwilling to back up his Mexican ambitions with the necessary military force, so Carlotta went to Rome to beg for help from the Pope. On the way, she began behaving strangely. Modern psychiatry would doubtless have a more precise diagnosis, but the language of her day seems more appropriate. Carlotta went mad. She became convinced that an organ grinder on the street was a Mexican colonel in disguise, and that spies of every sort were trying to poison her. As a precaution, she ate only oranges and nuts, checking the peels and shells for signs of tampering. She made her coachman stop at Rome's Trevi Fountain so that she could fill a crystal pitcher with water certain not to be poisoned. In her hotel suite, she kept a small charcoal stove and, tied to table legs, several chickens, to be slaughtered and cooked only in her sight. With her obedient staff in despair, her room slowly filled with feathers and chicken droppings. Flushed and weeping, Carlotta burst in on the Pope one morning as he was finishing breakfast, dipped her fingers in his hot chocolate, and licked them hungrily, crying, "This at least is not poisoned. Everything they gave me is drugged, and I am starving, literally starving." A cardinal and the commander of the papal guards maneuvered her out of the room, whereupon Carlotta gave the guard's commander a list of her staff members who should be arrested for treachery. Carlotta's aide sent an urgent telegram to Leopold in Brussels. Since he did not want his sister rattling around Europe in this condition, nor on his hands at Laeken, he installed her and her keepers in a chateau at Tervuren, on the other side of Brussels. And there she remained. For fear of unhinging her further, no one dared tell her for some months of Maximilian's execution. When they finally did, Carlotta refused to believe them. She continued to send him letters and presents, believing that he would soon become Emperor of France, Spain, and Portugal. The collapse in so short a time of his sister's and brother-in-law's empire did not dampen Leopold's enthusiasm for one of his own. All around him he saw the stirrings of a new age of colonialism. This was the era in which the future South African politician and diamond magnate Cecil Rhodes would say, "I would annex the planets if I could." In 1875, Leopold tried to buy the Philippines from Spain, but was once again frustrated. "For the moment, neither the Spanish nor the Portuguese nor the Dutch are inclined to sell," he wrote to one of his officials that year, and then added, "I intend to find out discreetly if there's anything to be done in Africa." In the mid-1870s, sub-Saharan Africa was a logical place for an aspiring colonialist to look. The British and the Boers controlled South Africa, and an enfeebled Portugal claimed most of what used to be the Kingdom of the Congo, as well as Mozambique on the east coast. Along Africa's great western bulge, Portugal, Spain, Britain, and France owned a few islands and small pockets of territory. Otherwise, about 80% of the entire land area of Africa was still under indigenous rulers. It was ripe for conquest, or, as Leopold was now learning to say, for protection. Leopold carefully combed the proceedings of the Royal Geographical Society for information about the continent and closely followed the treks of white explorers. He amassed a big file of notes in nearly illegible handwriting. When the Scottish explorer Verney Lovett Cameron, about to become the first European to cross Africa from east to west, was reported in 1875 to be running out of money, Leopold swiftly offered a contribution of 100,000 francs. The money was not needed, it turned out, but the king's gesture declared him a patron of African exploration. Henry Morton Stanley at this time was in the midst of another expedition in Africa. He and his usual huge caravan of guards and porters had set off in 1874 from the east coast to the interior, heading for the biggest blank space on the map, the equatorial heart of the continent, where no European had yet been. On the way, he planned to map several of the great East African lakes and then push on to a large river west of them, which might be the start of the Nile or the Congo. While he was still near the coast, messengers brought back Stanley's newspaper dispatches. Then nothing more was heard from him. Livingstone, Stanley, and the other explorers, Leopold saw, had succeeded in stirring Europeans by their descriptions of the Arab slave traders leading sad caravans of chained captives to Africa's east coast. As king of a small country with no public interest in colonies, he recognized that a colonial push of his own would require a strong humanitarian veneer. Curbing the slave trade, moral uplift, and the advancement of science were the aims he would talk about, not profits. In 1876, he began planning a step to establish his image as a philanthropist and advance his African ambitions. He would host a conference of explorers and geographers. He sent a trusted aide to Berlin to recruit German participants, while he himself slipped across the English Channel to London, settling into a suite at Claridge's. By this time, he was far from being the awkward, naive youngster who had visited Queen Victoria on his honeymoon more than 20 years earlier. As we watch him now moving about London, for the first time in his life he seems polished and cosmopolitan, at ease and quietly purposeful. He moves mainly in a world of men, but he remembers the names of their wives and children, and always asks about them warmly. His frustrations are concealed, his raw lust for colonies moderated by the knowledge that he must depend on subterfuge and flattery. He pays a visit to dear cousin Victoria at Balmoral Castle in Scotland, dines twice with her son, the Prince of Wales, and visits eminent geographers and military men. Shrewdly, he also goes to lunch with Baroness Angela Burdett Coutts, a well-known patron of missionaries. Most important, he meets the explorer Cameron, recently returned from crossing Africa, and grills him about his travels. To his delight, Leopold finds that the British have little interest in the great swath of territory Cameron has just explored. Most of it is believed to be the basin of the Congo River, although Cameron himself travelled far south of the river and, like everyone else in Europe, still has no clear idea of its course. This is the land that now becomes the object of the king's desires. In September 1876, Leopold's geographical conference convened in Brussels. In the orders he gave to subordinates, no detail of protocol, however minute, escaped his attention. The names must be spelled just as I have written them. GCB means Grand Cross of Bath. FRGS means Fellow of the Royal Geographical Society. KCB means Knight Commander of the Bath. These letters must be written after the names. He sent a Belgian ship across the channel to Dover for the British guests and had a special express train bring them the rest of the way. He issued orders that all those coming to the conference should be waved across the Belgian frontier without customs formalities. Representatives, who came from all the major European countries, were appropriately greeted by Leopold in English, French, or German. Among the 13 Belgians and 24 foreign guests were famous explorers like France's Marquis de Compiègne, who had gone up the Ogowe River in Gabon, and Germany's Gerhard Rolfs, who had had himself circumcised so that he could pass for a Muslim while trekking to remote parts of the Sahara. Geographers like Baron Ferdinand von Richthofen, the president of the Berlin Geographical Society. Humanitarians like Sir Thomas Fowell Buxton, president of Britain's Anti-Slavery Society, and Sir John Kennaway, president of the Church Missionary Society. Business executives like William MacKinnon of the British India Line, and military men like Rear Admiral Sir Leopold Heath of England, who had headed the Royal Navy's Indian Ocean Anti-Slavery Patrol, and Vice Admiral Baron de la Rancière-Lunerie, president of the Paris Geographical Society. Never in the 19th century had so many eminent Europeans in the field of exploration gathered in one spot, and the guests were delighted to become acquainted with one another in the luxurious surroundings of the Royal Palace. Almost the only notable European concerned with Africa who was not there was Stanley, whose work the conference acknowledged with a formal resolution. He was, everyone hoped, still alive somewhere in the middle of the continent. There had been no news of him for months. Leopold knew that even the wealthy and well-born would be delighted to live in a palace. The only complication was that the Royal Palace, in downtown Brussels, was really the king's office. The royal family's home was the suburban Chateau of Laeken. And so the Royal Palace's staff quarters and offices were hastily converted to guest bedrooms. To make room for the visitors, some servants slept in linen closets, and desks, books, and filing cabinets were moved to the basement or the stables. On the opening day, dazzled conference participants filed up a new Baroque grand staircase of white marble to be received by Leopold in a throne room illuminated by 7,000 candles. The king awarded the Cross of Leopold to everyone he had invited. "I have a suite of magnificent apartments to myself, all crimson damask and gold," Major General Sir Henry Rawlingson of the Royal Geographical Society wrote to his wife the first night. "Everything is red, even the ink and the ammunition, toilet paper." Leopold's welcoming speech was a masterpiece. It clothed the whole enterprise in noble rhetoric, staked out his own role in what was to come, and guaranteed his plans a stamp of approval by the group he was hosting. To open to civilization the only part of our globe which it has not yet penetrated, to pierce the darkness which hangs over entire peoples, is, I dare say, a crusade worthy of this century of progress. It seemed to me that Belgium, a centrally located and neutral country, would be a suitable place for such a meeting. Need I say that in bringing you to Brussels, I was guided by no egotism? No, gentlemen, Belgium may be a small country, but she is happy and satisfied with her fate. I have no other ambition than to serve her well. He ended by naming the specific tasks he hoped the conference would accomplish. Among them, deciding on the location of routes to be successively opened into the interior, of hospitable, scientific, and pacification bases to be set up as a means of abolishing the slave trade, establishing peace among the chiefs, and procuring them just and impartial arbitration. Between sumptuous banquets, those attending the conference pulled out their maps and marked points in the blank space of Central Africa for such hospitable, scientific, and pacification bases. Each one, the high-minded guests decided, would be staffed by half a dozen or so unarmed Europeans, scientists, linguists, and artisans who would teach practical skills to the natives. Every post would contain laboratories for studying local soil, weather, fauna, and flora, and would be well stocked with supplies for explorers. Maps, trading goods, spare clothing, tools to repair scientific instruments, an infirmary with all the latest medicines. Chairing the conference, Leopold stayed modestly in the background, was the Russian geographer Pyotr Semenov. In honor of Semenov's daring exploration of the Tian Shan Mountains of Central Asia, the Tsar had granted him the right to add Tian Shansky to his name. Semenov, however, knew next to nothing about Africa, which suited Leopold perfectly. He was easily able to maneuver Semenov so that the chain of bases endorsed by the conference would stretch across the unclaimed territory of the Congo River Basin that interested Leopold most. The British participants had wanted some of these posts nearer to British possessions. Before the guests dispersed to their respective countries, they voted to establish the International African Association. Leopold magnanimously volunteered space in Brussels for the organization's headquarters. There were to be national committees of the association set up in all the participating countries, as well as an international committee. Leopold was elected by acclamation as the international committee's first chairman. Self-effacingly, he said that he would serve for 1 year only, so that the chairmanship could rotate among people from different countries. He presented each guest with a gilt-framed portrait of himself in dress uniform, and the awed dignitaries and explorers headed home. The new body was welcomed throughout Europe. Prominent citizens from the Rothschilds to Viscount Ferdinand de Lesseps, the builder of the Suez Canal, hastened to send contributions. The national committees, which sounded impressive, were to be headed by grand dukes, princes, and other royals, but most of them never got off the ground. The International Committee did meet once in the following year, re-elected Leopold as chairman, despite his earlier pledge not to serve again, and then evaporated. Nonetheless, Leopold had, fox-like, gone a step forward. He had learned from his many attempts to buy a colony that none was for sale. He would have to conquer it. Doing this openly, however, was certain to upset both the Belgian people and the major powers of Europe. If he was to seize anything in Africa, he could do so only if he convinced everyone that his interest was purely altruistic. In this aim, thanks to the International African Association, he succeeded brilliantly. Viscount de Lesseps, for one, declared Leopold's plans the greatest humanitarian work of this time. If we take a step back and look at Leopold at this moment, we can imagine him the political equivalent of an ambitious theatrical producer. He has organizational talent and the public's goodwill, as proven by his successful geographical conference. He has a special kind of capital, the great public relations power of the throne itself. He has a script, the dream of a colony that had been running through his head since he was a teenager. But he has as yet no stage, no cast. One day in September 1877, however, while the King Producer is planning his next move, a bulletin in the London Daily Telegraph from a small town on the west coast of Africa announces some remarkable news. It is just the opening Leopold has been waiting for. Stage and star have appeared, and the play can begin. Chapter 3. The Magnificent Cake. The town of Boma lay on the Congo River's north shore, about 50 miles in from the Atlantic Ocean. Besides its African inhabitants, 16 whites lived there, most of them Portuguese, rough, hard-bitten men used to wielding the whip and the gun, who ran a few small trading posts. Like Europeans for several centuries before them, these traders had never trekked inland through the forbidding jumble of rocks lining the great river on the tumultuous 220 miles of intermittent rapids that carried it down to sea level. On August 5, 1877, an hour after sunset, four bedraggled black men walked out of the bush at Boma. They had come from a village some 2 days' walk inland and were carrying a letter addressed to "Any gentleman who speaks English at Mboma." "Dear Sir, I have arrived at this place from Zanzibar with 115 souls, men, women, and children. We are now in a state of imminent starvation. But if your supplies arrive in time, I may be able to reach Mboma within 4 days. Better than all would be 10 or 15 manloads of rice or grain. The supplies must arrive within 2 days, or I may have a fearful time of it among the dying. Yours sincerely, H. M. Stanley, Commanding Anglo-American Expedition for Exploration of Africa." At dawn the next day, the traders sent Stanley porters carrying potatoes, fish, rice, and canned food. They realized instantly what the letter meant. Stanley had crossed the entire African continent from east to west. But unlike Verney Lovett Cameron, the only European to do this before him, he had emerged at the Congo's mouth. He must, therefore, have followed the river itself, becoming the first white man to chart its course and to solve the mystery of where it came from. Resupplied just in time, Stanley and the haggard survivors of his expedition slowly walked the rest of the way to Boma. Since leaving Zanzibar just off the east coast, they had covered a zigzag course of more than 7,000 miles and had been travelling for more than 2.5 years. A Welshman masquerading as a native-born United States citizen, Stanley was both the Anglo and the American of his Anglo-American expedition. The name, however, acknowledged that this trip, far more expensive and ambitious than his search for Livingstone, was financed both by James Gordon Bennett's New York Herald and Edward Levy Lawson's London Daily Telegraph. Stanley's dispatches appeared in both papers, and he bestowed the names of their owners on his route across Africa: Mount Gordon Bennett, the Gordon Bennett River, the Levy Hills, Mount Lawson. He left his own name on Stanley Falls in the center of the continent and on a spot about 1,000 miles downstream at the head of the rapids where the Congo River widened into a lake. He claimed that naming the latter was the idea of his second-in-command, Frank Pocock, who cried out, "Why, this signal expanse we shall call Stanley Pool." Pocock was not able to confirm this. He drowned in the river soon after christening, or not christening, this portion of it. On the eve of his formidable trans-African journey, Stanley had once again fallen in love, this time with Alice Pike, a 17-year-old American heiress. Falling for a flighty teenager half his age just before leaving for 3 years was not the most likely path to wedded bliss, which may have been just what attracted Stanley, who remained fearful of women. He and Alice agreed to marry on his return, signed a marriage pact, and fixed the date of the wedding. It was after his new love that Stanley named the expedition's key means of transport. The Lady Alice was a 40-foot boat of Spanish cedar, divided into 5 sections. When the sections were fastened together, the boat could be rowed along African lakes and rivers. When they were separated and slung from poles, they could be carried overland by teams of porters for hundreds of miles. Stanley was always uncomfortable with anyone whose talents might outshine his own. From the 1,200 men who applied to join the expedition, some of them highly experienced travellers, he chose 3 unsuitable companions: a pair of sailor fishermen, the brothers Frank and Edward Pocock, and a young hotel clerk named Frederick Barker. Edward Pocock's main skill seems to have been playing the bugle. None of the 3 had had any experience exploring. When the 4 white men marched westward into the interior at the head of the Anglo-American expedition, they led a group close to double the size of Stanley's expedition to find Livingstone, 356 people all told. 46 were women and children, for some of the senior Africans had been granted the privilege of taking along their families. This miniature army carried more than 16,000 pounds of arms, equipment, and goods that could be traded for food along the way. On the march, the column stretched for 0.5 mile, a distance so long that halts had to be signalled by Edward Pocock's bugle. The bugle calls were appropriate. For Stanley, continual combat was always part of exploring. He never bothered to count the dead that the expedition left behind it, but the number must have been in the hundreds. Stanley's party carried the latest rifles and an elephant gun with exploding bullets. The unlucky people they fought had spears, bows and arrows, or, at best, ancient muskets bought from slave traders. "We have attacked and destroyed 28 large towns and 3 or 4 score villages," he wrote in his journal. Most of the fighting took place on lakes and rivers, with the explorer and his men flying the British and American flags and firing from the Lady Alice and dugout canoes. The thin-skinned Stanley was remarkably frank about his tendency to take any show of hostility as a deadly insult. It is almost as if vengeance were the force driving him across the continent. As he piloted the Lady Alice toward a spot on Lake Tanganyika, for instance, the beach was crowded with infuriates and mockers. We perceived we were followed by several canoes, in some of which we saw spears shaken at us. I opened on them with the Winchester repeating rifle. 6 shots and 4 deaths were sufficient to quiet the mocking. In the early months of the journey, Stanley was able to describe such skirmishes in newspaper stories carried by messengers to Africa's east coast, where they were relayed to England by sea and telegraph. There they stirred a storm of outrage from humanitarian groups like the Aborigines Protection Society and the Anti-Slavery Society. "Stanley shoots Negroes as if they were monkeys," commented the explorer and writer Richard Burton. The British Foreign Secretary, however, seemed far more upset that this brash writer for the popular press, who claimed to be an American, was flying the Union Jack. He sent Stanley a pompous message declaring that such display was not authorized. To the New York Herald's vehemently anti-British publisher, James Gordon Bennett, Jr., the controversy brought nothing but delight. He lashed out enthusiastically at Stanley's critics as the howling dervishes of civilization, safe in London, the philanthropists, whose impractical view is that a leader should permit his men to be slaughtered by the natives and should be slaughtered himself and let discovery go to the dogs, but should never pull a trigger against this species of human vermin. Among the achievements of this first stage of his travels, Stanley claimed, was telling the Emperor of Uganda about the 10 Commandments and converting him to Christianity. However, a French officer who happened to be visiting Uganda at this time later said that Stanley convinced the Emperor only by telling him that Christians had 11 Commandments. The 11th was, "Honor and respect kings, for they are the envoys of God." After months of carrying heavy loads, many of the expedition's porters mutinied, pilfered supplies, and fled. Again and again Stanley dealt out swift punishment. "The murderer of Membe," he wrote in his diary, "was sentenced to 200 lashes, the 2 drunkards to 100 lashes each, and to be kept in chains for 6 months. Later, he wrote of his porters, "They are faithless, lying, thievish, indolent knaves who only teach a man to despise himself for his folly in attempting a grand work with such miserable slaves." With his fiancée, Alice Pike, he took a different tone, writing on his first Christmas of the expedition, "How your kind woman's heart would pity me and mine. The camp is in the extreme of misery, and the people appear as if they were making up their minds to commit suicide, or to sit still inert until death relieves them." Always carrying her photograph with him, wrapped safely in oilskin, Stanley marked on his map an Alice Island and the Lady Alice Rapids. "I do love dancing so much," Alice wrote to him. "I would rather go to an opera than a party. Almost every evening some fellows come in. I get awfully tired of them. I have the most horrid sore finger all blistered from playing the harp. I am getting along quite well with it, only I never practice." She apparently had little idea of where Stanley was, or that letters from him, if they could be delivered at all, had to be carried through the bush for months. "You never write to me any more," she complained, "and I just want to know why. I am real angry with Central Africa." In the book he later wrote about this expedition, Through the Dark Continent, Stanley followed several rules he would use in books to come. Stretch the account to 2 volumes, a total of 960 pages in this case. Use dark in the title, In Darkest Africa, and My Dark Companions and Their Strange Stories would follow, and employ every possible medium for telling the story. There are before and after photographs of the author showing his hair turned white by the journey. Extracts from my diary. When compared with Stanley's actual journal, they turn out to be nothing of the sort. An elaborate fold-out map marked with the route of the trip. More than 100 drawings of battles, dramatic meetings, a canoe being sucked into a whirlpool, floor plans of African houses, street plans of villages, lists of supplies. A cornucopia of diagrams shows everything from the lineages of African kings to the shapes of different canoe paddles. Stanley shrewdly sensed that his reader's ignorance of Africa would make them all the more fascinated by endless mundane details, such as a chart of prices showing that a chicken cost 1 bead necklace at Abadi, while 6 chickens cost 12 yards of cloth in Ugogo. Readers got their money's worth. Pre-electronic though they were, Stanley's books were multimedia productions. To read Stanley today is to see how much his travelling was an act of appropriation. He is forever measuring and tabulating things, temperature, miles travelled, lake depths, latitude, longitude, and altitude, which he calculated by measuring the temperature at which water boiled. Specially trusted porters carried fragile loads of thermometers, barometers, watches, compasses, and pedometers. It is almost as if he were a surveyor mapping the continent he crossed for its prospective owners. It is the second half of Stanley's journey which turns it into an epic feat of exploration. From Lake Tanganyika, where he had found Livingstone several years earlier, he and his diminished band of porters, including some rebellious ones who start the trip in chains, trek westward into the interior for some weeks, until they reach a large river known locally as the Lualaba. No European explorer has ever gone downstream beyond this point, and no one knows where the Lualaba leads. Livingstone had thought it was the long-sought source of the Nile, since the Lualaba here flows north, straight toward Egypt. Stanley, however, is sure the Lualaba is far too big to be the beginning of the Nile. For a time he thinks it might be the Niger, whose outlet, like the Nile's, is far to the north. Then, descending the river, he becomes increasingly convinced that it is the Congo. But he is not certain, for the estuary where the Congo empties into the Atlantic, half a continent away, is south of the point where his celestial bearings show him to be, on the shore of the northward-flowing Lualaba. On European maps, everything in between is blank. According to Stanley, he stands on the banks of this mysterious river and addresses his assembled followers. "Into whichever sea this great river empties, there shall we follow it. On your lives depends my own. If I risk yours, I risk mine. As a father looks after his children, I will look after you. Therefore, my children, make up your minds, as I have made up mine, that as we are now in the very middle of this continent, and it would be just as bad to return as to go on, we shall continue our journey, that we shall toil on, and by this river, and no other, to the salt sea." Frank Pocock, the faithful deputy, asks, "Before we finally depart, sir, do you really believe in your inmost soul that we shall succeed?" To which Stanley replies, "Believe? Yes, I do believe that we shall all emerge into light again sometime. It is true that our prospects are as dark as this night. I believe this river will prove to be the Congo. If the Congo, then there must be many cataracts. Whether the Congo, the Niger, or the Nile, I am prepared. Believe? I see us gliding down by tower and town, and my mind will not permit a shadow of doubt. Good night, my boy. Good night, and may happy dreams of the sea and ships and pleasure and comfort and success attend you in your sleep." Did Stanley really stand on the river bank and speak words even remotely like these? We will never know, because none of the other 3 white men on the expedition survived. Long before Frank Pocock drowned, Fred Barker died of aguish fits, so severe that his blood seemed to stagnate in its veins until the congealed blood would not run, and the poor young man was dead. Edward Pocock became delirious. "I sprang to him," Stanley claims, only in time, however, to see him take his last gasp. If the Lualaba was going to turn out to be the Congo, Stanley knew, the river had to somewhere make a 180-degree curve. As he and his expedition floated down it, or at the beginning sometimes marched alongside it, he frequently measured his latitude and longitude. For several 100 miles, the river mystifyingly continued to flow north. But at last it began to make a wide counterclockwise arc to the west, ending up flowing southwest towards its fearsome cataracts and the Atlantic. Stanley's journey solved another geographical mystery. The Congo begins and ends below the equator, but the top part of its great half-circle lies above the equator. In Central Africa, the equator is the rough dividing line between the dry and rainy seasons. When it is one above the line, it is the other below. Therefore, whatever the time of year, part of the Congo's course passes through land being drenched with rain, and part through dry country. This explained why, over the course of a year, the Congo's flow varied much less than that of other tropical rivers. The gigantic, steadily widening river, Stanley found, was a rich source of food for the people living near it. Since his time, scientists have counted more than 500 species of fish in the river. These feed on an array of insects, on each other, and on fruit and leaves that fall into the water, especially during flood seasons when the river rises above its bank and sheets of water sweep through the bordering forests and grasslands. It is frustrating that the only African voices we hear are those recorded by Stanley himself. Every once in a while he does note or imagine